This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the businessman Tim Martin. The founder of J.D. Weatherspoon, he runs 900-odd pubs. By anyone's reckoning, that's a lot of booze and grub to dish up. A lot of staff, too. He employs 37,000 people. And whilst hipster fads for Vietnamese food trucks or pop-up vegan cafes come and go, it seems our taste for a pint of Ruddles and a plate of scampi and chips is greater than ever. This year, his company's profits are up 25% on sales of 1.6 billion. He was originally destined for the bar of a different sort. As a young man, he qualified as a barrister, but a fear of public speaking led him instead to open his first establishment, Martin's Free House. He seems to be over his shyness now, having recently and repeatedly spoken up publicly in favour of Brexit. In the run-up to the referendum, he even printed 500,000 beer mats explaining the case for Britain leaving the EU. His business philosophy is much like his philosophy on life. He says, don't try and change the world, but if you can, just make tiny tweaks every day to make it that bit better. That's a very powerful force over time. And so welcome, Tim Martin. I described you there as a businessman, but just a moment ago, before we opened the microphones, you described yourself as a publican.
Yes, my day-to-day life involves running pubs and trying to make the tweaks you mentioned. So it's more precise to say publican.
You visit quite a few establishments a week, 10 pubs a week?
Well, I try not to let it ever drop below 10, but average is probably 12, 14 a week.
I managed to get a sneaky little look at the notes you make, which are usually highly private and confidential. And I noticed, I mean, they're very, very detailed. There are photographs in there too. One of your notes said, very good breakfast wrap, but cutlery quite poor. So it's all about the detail, is it?
Yes, I go into pubs and try and imagine that I'm a customer and try and imagine what they'd be looking for. I also try and park half a mile away from each pub, so I get a mile walk there and back, but also walk through the town and see how our pubs look when you've arrived at it in cold blood from somewhere else, rather than parking round the back.
These are unannounced visits, and of course part of building a business is taking the team with you. What's your advice about that, about people not saying, oh God, here he comes?
I think what we've learned over the years is that what we, the directors and senior managers, know is far less than the collective intelligence of the customers and the people who work in the pubs. So it's our job to go in there, not peeve them off with our authoritarianism, speak to them and get ideas from the coalface. And then every week we make decisions in concert with them. When I go to the office and we have our weekly meetings, we've got pub managers and area managers who sit in all the meetings.
Do you think that all of the small pubs that are closing are doing so because your great big chain is sort of gobbling up the high street?
I don't think so, because if you look at London, where we've got most pubs, two of the most successful companies have been Young's and Fuller's, which have adapted themselves to our presence and become very, very good indeed. So I think you'd find that a lot of pubs have shut down in areas where Weatherspoon isn't, smaller villages, suburbs. But we do better if there are other pubs and restaurants near us.
Right.
So we're not trying to kill everyone off.
You have said inactivity equals unhappiness. You are somebody who believes in, what, a bit of exercise every day?
Yes.
Why? Why is that important?
I found when I was younger that I was quite a stressy sort of guy. And I found the way for me to convert anxiety into a positive force was to take exercise. If you can do an hour or two up on your hind legs and avoid too much soya, which is sitting on your ass, then I think it's better for everyone. You might live longer or you might not.
Tell me about your first piece of music, Tim Martin. What are we going to hear?
The first one is a guy very popular in the 1970s, Loudon Wainwright III. He hasn't got a good idea of a pub, which a lot of people have to say don't, and this is a brilliant Mickey take of someone who drinks too much in a pub.
Then I do my usual thing. Let the phone ring and ring and ring and ring and ring and ring. I'm standing there in the phone booth, coping with the ugly truth.
Loudon Wainwright III, down drinking at the bar. Tim Martin, you've printed all these bar mats and very recently you've done this manifesto for a successful Brexit. There are very many places, both here on Radio 4 and, of course, beyond, where people are discussing at great length the ins and outs of Brexit. And for our purposes, I want to discuss you at great length. So I'm not going to go into all of that, but I am interested in the fact that you've got 2,000 or 3,000 people from other EU countries currently working your business, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. They're young, they're enthusiastic, they want to engage in the hospitality industry, a growing industry in Britain. If we're not in the EU, we don't have that. And that will fundamentally affect the prices that people pay, the atmosphere, all the things that people enjoy about our hospitality here in the UK. What would you say to all those people in your industry who are shouting that message loud and clear right now?
I'd say, you're right in a way, folks. Immigration is a good thing, but you don't need to give your democracy away in order to have what you want.
So you're talking there about, I mean, we hear often cited the Australian point system is let plenty people in, but let us choose specifically who those people are. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. I'm saying subject to the will of the people, immigration is a good thing. You need a slightly rising population as the years go by to have a successful economy in a successful country. There's quite a low birth rate. So use a point system.
Of course, a majority of people voted for Brexit and many of them complain at what they see as the relentlessly over-pessimistic view of the media in its representation of what's going on currently. You yourself, as somebody who's been vocal and engaged in all of this, how have you found your treatment?
I found my treatment by the media excellent. And that's across all the media. I do think the media have faithfully tried to report what people say. Obviously, people in the media have their own views, I suppose. A lot come from London, and it so happens that they're Remainers. But I think people have, on the whole, tried very hard to be unbiased, apart from some newspapers, which I think could have done better to present both sides. They've been a bit too doctrinaire.
A great wave of, well, let's be polite and call it surprise, overtook the media the day after the vote. As somebody who's in his pubs every week, who is out there facing the customer, how surprised were you at the result?
I was pretty surprised. This is an egotistical story, but I was asked to be on David Dimbleby's referendum show and I dipped out at the last minute because I thought we were going to lose. And I thought, I'm not going to be there and saying, yes, the best man won.
Let's have some more music, Tim Martin. We're going to listen to your second one. Tell me a little bit about this. Why is it on your list?
This is a song from Van Morrison, and I'd say it's an ode to work. It's got all the fantastic music you expect from Van Morrison, but I love the line, I'm a working man in my prime, cleaning windows, because I think work's vital for most of us, for all of us, really.
What's my life? I'll have to be cleaning windows. Take my time. I'll see you when my love grows. Baby, don't let it slide. I'm a working man in my prime. Cleaning windows.
Number 36.
Glorying there, Tim Martin, you were in everything that is Van Morrison. That was cleaning windows. You spent a lot of time in Northern Ireland as a kid. You were born in 1955 in Norwich, and then your dad moved because of his job. Just tell me a little bit about your father.
He went to school in Dungannon in Northern Ireland, where my mother was born, and they married. He went to Cramwell at the age of 18. He then got married and was a fighter pilot in the RAF aerobatics team, golden boy at school, top athlete, very good rugby player, captain of the rugby team, quite a glamour boy.
Tell me a bit about your mum and dad as parents. What sort of parents were they?
They had a very fiery relationship, and basically they didn't really get on, especially after the old man left the RAF when I was about six. We went back to Northern Ireland and had a turbulent time. But they sank their differences. We went to New Zealand for 5 years, but then when we came back when I was 15 to Belfast, they split up. And then I still remained friendly with my father, but not so much with my mother from that time on.
Can you remember as a little boy what you were interested in? What did you like doing?
I think one of my two brothers and I were both very sporty, like the old man.
You're a big guy. What height are you now?
6'6". I was 6'3" at 13, so I was always the biggest guy in the class.
Right.
And always played a lot of sports. And I was in the school football under-11 team at 7, I remember. I was possibly my greatest sporting achievement. And when we went to New Zealand, we were both very sporty, like a lot of kids, but we took it seriously.
Yes. You mentioned your dad was in the aerobatics flying squad in the RAF. Was there a sense in which anything you do, you take it to the limit?
Not from being pushed by my parents, I wouldn't say. They wanted me to work hard at school, but I had this feeling from when I was a kid, slightly nutty feeling, that if I wanted to do something, I definitely could do it. And I had no doubt at all I could become... It's a terrible thing to say, I know, I won't be doing myself any favours, but if you really, really concentrate on something, there's a deal of truth in it, you can achieve it.
Was there any sign when you were a little kid of that entrepreneurial spirit? I mean, did you start a small business when you were at school?
No, I think one of the things that helps is to swim against the tide, as a guy called Sam Walton of Walmart said, as a key characteristic of an entrepreneur. So I was always a bolshy little git. And I always felt I knew better and wasn't frightened to say it, probably to too great an extent.
Tell me about your next piece of music. We're going to listen to your third disc of the day.
This is a song by the Beach Boys, Do It Again. Amazing sound, unique sound, the Beach Boys. No one's ever produced music like them. And this one reminds me of the beach, surfing, youth, and it's an ecstatic record.
It's automatic.
That was the Beach Boys and Do It Again. So, Tim Martin, a self-confessed bolshy little kid. Let's talk then about this kid getting a little bit older. That was out in 69, that track, and by that time you were enjoying a surfing life and your parents decided that they wanted to send you to boarding school. They took you to boarding school. Tell me what happened.
My old man decided that I was getting too grown up. I was hanging out with the surf dudes, smoking cigarettes, and he went into a pub, and you weren't allowed to drink till you were 21 in New Zealand, and he saw me in there having a pint, and he was the Guinness rep in New Zealand.
Were you drinking Guinness at least? Was it?
It wasn't even Guinness. And they decided I should go to boarding school, where both my parents had been. And they took me off to a place called New Plymouth, which was 250 miles away. And it was a school with a military training for the first week. So I went there for one night and ran away and hitchhiked home 250 miles. I was away overnight and there was police alert. But I got home before the old man.
What was the problem? Why didn't you like it?
I was in love with a gal back in Auckland,
so
that was enough for me.
And so they took you back, presumably, did they? And
No, they gave up then. Really, I was 6'3", and they realised there's only so much you can do. It's terrible, isn't it? I know I am awful.
So your parents moved back to Northern Ireland. Your dad transferred him back to Northern Ireland. By this stage, you were around about 15?
Yeah, just before I was 15.
And this was to Belfast. Now, this was a crucial moment in the history of Ireland and Northern Ireland. It was a time at which the Troubles were in full flare.
The Troubles really were in full flare, so it was a bit of a culture shock. And I don't want to overplay it, but the parents got divorced and being taken away from New Zealand. Both my brothers went to boarding school. I stayed in the house with my old man, so suddenly it was just me and him for a while. And he was busy, he was working, and he was traumatised too. But it didn't last for that long because my father went abroad to live in Jamaica and I went to live with another family, and that was great. So the trauma then was short-lived. In fact, it was less traumatic probably than some of the previous 15 years.
And so, you know, this was the early 70s. You went to, it sounds to me when I read about it, like a pretty sort of posh grammar school in Northern Ireland. It was Campbell College. That suited you better, did it?
Yeah, I mean, I was just such a pain for the teachers in Campbell College. I blush when I think about my bolshy behaviour, but I was the only guy they had who was 6 foot six and 16 stone in the rugby team.
So they needed to keep you there.
So they needed me. Just about kept me at the school. But actually, after a while there, to be fair, I did work very hard as well, and I got my O-levels and I got my A-levels.
Let's take a break, Tim. Let's have some music. We're going to hear your fourth.
This is a great song. Came out when I was 12, 13, 14, that period when you're starting to get interested in gals. And it's very romantic, nostalgic, and the amazing combination of Johnny Cash's booming voice and the great Bob Dylan's wonderful song.
When the river's free, please see for me if she's wearing a coat so warm to keep her from the howling wind. If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline.
That was Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash and Girl from the North Country. Tim Martin, you went to 11 different schools. You're a father of four now grown-up children yourself. How do you think this rather robust childhood that you had affected the way that you then parented your own kids?
It's very difficult to say. I think there's so much a natural instinct in what you do. But I never fell out with any of my children, and I never even got angry with them, really. But I did tell them what to do, and I'm so pleased that I've got on so well with them. That's just not possible with all kids or all people, so don't feel bad if it doesn't happen to you, is what I would say.
And you went on to read law at Nottingham University. You've been married for a very good long time to Felicity. How did you meet?
I can't believe I'm this old, but I met on my 20th birthday. I invited her to my birthday party. I'd had a couple of pints in the bar at university, and as I wandered by, I plucked up the courage, fortified by a couple of pints of Nottinghamshire bitter, to ask if she wanted to come along. And to my intense surprise, she said yes.
You finished your law degree in 1977. You were going to become a barrister. I mean, why did you want to do that?
I finished my law degree in 77 and decided I was going to chuck it in because I wasn't very good at it. I struggled to understand it quickly. I could get by. And I worked for 6 months in a pork pie factory and then worked for 6 months selling advertising space in the Newcastle Journal in London. And I thought the law was bad, but selling advertising space was worse. So I went back and did my bar exams in Central
London.
So
you fully qualified, but you never practised?
Yes.
And it was...
Fully qualified... by the skin of my teeth.
Right. Well, it's still qualifying,
it's
isn't it?
It's still qualifying.
And so partly, as I said in my introduction today, I had read that it was because you didn't like this idea of public speaking.
I was very paranoid about public speaking. I don't know why, I just got a phobia about it. At university, I stopped going to lectures, and at the bar, I went to two bar exam lectures in the whole year, and they started asking questions, and I got so nervous, I never went to another one.
So quite crippling then?
Yeah, it was crippling if I'd had to go, but since I didn't have to go, right. I did what I did at boarding school and just headed off. But I studied it from books.
Some more music, Tim Martin. We are going to hear your fifth choice on your list of eight.
This is the wild 60s and 70s rocker Captain Beefheart. And I remember this from my A-level years. And there was a refrain in it, which was keep on walking and don't look back. And for some reason, it just stuck in my mind. My wife thinks I've got a mild case of Tourette's. So if I'm having a shower, you can hear me say, keep on walking and don't look back. To myself.
Keep on walking and don't look back. Blew around the corner, the wind blew back. Followed the yellow brick road. It ended up at Black Bow. Black Bow's taught the gift of love. Two island children painted joy. Sunshine bright, girl and boy. Bag of tricks and candy sticks. Peppermint kite for my toy. Yellow brick, Black Bow, black. Keep on walking and don't look back.
That was Captain Beefheart and Yellow Brick Road. Let's then try to understand, Tim Martin, how you went from being a qualified barrister who didn't want to practice to opening a pub. It was called Martin's Free House, your first pub. How did that happen? Why did you want to do it and how did you get to do it?
Well, I'd got the absolutely insane idea after leaving university that I could become a great squash player. I read an article about a guy called Jonah Barrington, and at 18 and 19, he decided he was going to practice 24 hours a day and become world champion, and he did. So I tried this and got absolutely nowhere at all. 10 years later, I saw the Open squash final at Wembley, and I was heavier, I realised, than both of the finalists together.
Yes, you don't seem a natural squash player.
I was a natural rugby player,
yes.
But I'd blown it by then. The whole thing was a debacle, really, but... you've got to try. So I went back to doing my bar exams, but I had no intention of being a barrister. I thought it was a good qualification. And cutting a long story short, someone had converted a bookies into a pub just down the road. And they said, you should go there for a pint. It's really good. And pubs in London were poor. I started going there while I was doing my bar exams. And the guy decided he wanted out. And I took over his 8-year lease of a pub that was the size of your studio.
How good were you at it in the beginning?
I was just so bad. And I did everything wrong for quite a prolonged period of time. In fact, if I could have got out, I probably would have done. I couldn't because I'd signed a lease. We weren't making any money.
It was a good few years before you made any money.
It was 4 years before we made a decent profit, although we did have 3 or 4 pubs by then. So even though I was no good at it, my ego was such that I still expanded. The pub was very busy, and the instinct that we could do better than other pubs was quite strong. And we weren't tied to a brewer, and most pubs were tied to brewers then, so it gave us a big advantage. And the other thing is you couldn't buy pubs then because they all belonged to the brewers who wouldn't sell them. So the real thing we pioneered was getting a shop and getting planning permission and a license for a pub, which people more or less thought was impossible on a big scale then.
By the time you had these 3 or 4 pubs that you weren't brilliant at running, but maybe getting a bit better, how in debt were you and to whom?
I was in debt to everyone, but heavily into the banks.
Did that worry you?
Yeah. Floating on the stock market for us was when it became everyone else's issue as well, and we raised plenty of money.
In those early days, did Felicity have an opinion?
She didn't ever tell me to stop. Unlike me, she's not a natural worrier. Oh, well, don't worry. Someone will come away, take the pubs, take the house, take the car.
So and hopefully
what's the
take
problem?
You if they've got a big enough truck, yes.
Which is an unusually laid-back approach.
It certainly is. Felicity, I doff my cap. Right, let's have some more music, Tim Martin. Time for your sixth. Tell me about this.
This is a poem by Dylan Thomas, absolutely fantastic poet. Many of the ringing phrases in the English language come from him. A pal at school told me, another amateur philosopher like myself, that Poem in October was a brilliant poem, and he was right, and I've loved it ever since.
It was my 30th year to heaven, woke to my hearing from harbour and neighbour wood and the mussel pool and the heron priested shore. The morning beckon with water praying and call of seagull and rook and the knock of sailing boats on the net-webbed wall. Myself to set foot that second in the still sleeping town and set forth. My birthday began with the water birds and the birds of the winged trees flying my name above the farms and the white horses. And I rose in rainy autumn and walked abroad in a shower of all my days. High tide and the heron dived when I took the road over the border, and the gates of the town closed as the town awoke. A springful of larks in a rolling cloud and the roadside bushes brimming with whistling blackbirds and the sun of October summery on the hill's shoulder. Here were fond climates and sweet singers suddenly come in the morning, where I wandered and listened to the rain, ringing wind blow cold in the wood far away under me.
That was part of Poem in October, written by Dylan Thomas and read by Richard Burton. Tim Martin, there's a recurring theme when I speak to you, and it is whether it was meeting your wife, had a couple of pints and asked her, or I'd like to go for a pint. But how much do you drink in a typical week? What's your unit intake?
I have 2 or 3 days off a week when I only have one pint.
That's a day off.
That's a day off. Last night I cracked and had two when I was listening to these songs that are on the show today. But I try and stick to 3 or 4 pints maximum. So hopefully my doctor's not listening, and it's a perfectly reasonable number of units, Your Honour.
I'm sure you are constantly asked by young people, all sorts of people, who want to start their own business. What would be your 1 or 2 bits of advice?
A lot of people tell young people it's a great thing to do, but it's only a great thing to do if you've got the right personality to do it. If you haven't got the right personality and you're not a bit of a maniac, it's probably best to give it a miss. But if you do it, the main characteristic is persistence and listen. It's not what the guy who's running the business thinks, it's what everyone else thinks, and that needs to be absorbed and distilled by successful business people.
And when you are chatting, as you do every week, to managers and deputy managers and bar staff, do you ever say to them, never ever say this to the customer?
No, and I also tell them you don't have to smile either.
You tell them not, they don't have to smile.
They don't have to smile, no. We don't go out of our way to tell them to be nice, because I think that puts too much pressure on people. I think when you go to a pub, you get a beer, someone's natural personality will emerge better if they're not under too much pressure, which of course they are under tremendous pressure anyway. So some of our best bar staff are quite grumpy.
Let's have some more music, Tim Martin. Tell me about this. We're going to listen to your 7th now.
This is one from Dire Straits, Sultans of Swing. Strange little vignette. Mark Knopfler just arrived in London 40 years ago, and he goes past a pub where there's a band playing, and they're called the Sultans of Swing.
And Harry doesn't mind if he doesn't make the scene. He's got a daytime job. Saving it up Friday night with the Sultans, with the Sultans of Swing.
Dire Straits, Sultans of Swing. You're a father, as we know, Tim Martin, but also now a grandfather. How many grandkids have you got?
4.
Do you spend much time? Do you have much time to spend with them?
Yeah, I spend a fair bit of time. I've changed my lifestyle a bit because one of my grandchildren has got severe physical disabilities.
Right.
So I spend 5 or 6 sessions a week if I can, helping him to learn to sit up. So I've become his part-time physio.
What difference has your input in his life made?
Well, it's hard to say, really, but I took 3 months off work to stay with him for 3 months and did a lot of rolling. And at the end of it, he was able to sit up more or less, and he now sits up very well. So that sort of thing. But there are millions of people out there who deal with disabilities, and the main thing is time and energy. And we're lucky. We've got a big family and we're well off. I take my hat off to the single mums who haven't got either of those things.
What was it like for you stepping back from work and not doing it and focusing on something so entirely, intensely personal?
Well, nothing can stop me thinking about pubs. So even when I was lying on the floor rolling with my grandson, I was still plotting.
Were you?
Plotting and planning. So, but yeah, it's nice to do something different like that. And 12 years ago, I took a 6-month sabbatical as well.
And why was that at the time?
My old man died, and I just thought, I'm going to take 6 months off. We were all upset. And I just wanted to see what it would be like. I was 48, 49, had done pubs for a long time. But after 6 months, I was really glad to be back to work, rather sadly, I thought. I thought I was going to read the works of Shakespeare and learn Russian and French, but actually I found without work I did even less.
So you never seriously, even now, contemplate stepping away?
No, I'm 62. I'm hoping to work for another 40, 50 years and then have a long retirement. I've been accused of not being realistic.
What does your wife say? You've made a good big pile of money. Does she ever say to you, you know, now is the time that we can go and, you know, buy that house on a shoreline somewhere and just...
I think that's her idea of a nightmare. She said, whatever I do, I'm not allowed in the house during office hours.
Is that true?
Yeah, more or less.
How would you cope on this island then?
I much admire a lot of your guests, but a lot of them I think have been fibbing when they say they'd be very happy. I'd want to get the hell out as quickly as I could. I would struggle on an island. There's no pubs?
Not as far as I'm aware. Tell me about your 8th piece of music then, Tim Marson.
This is one by the great Bob Marley, a natural mystic. He's a musical philosopher, really, and a bit of a Dylan Thomas from Jamaica.
Natural mystic Bob Marley there. Tim, I'm going to give you, I give all my castaways the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you will be allowed to take one more book along. What's it going to be?
It's a book called The Dance to the Music of Time by Anthony Pohl, as I think he pronounced his own name. It is 12 volumes, but I was hoping you could give me a bit of latitude there.
We're going to have to find one huge volume, I think, and it's going to be some size, but you may take that. And a luxury, too. What's your luxury?
I was hoping I could take a boat building kit, but I didn't think you'd allow that, so it might have to be a surfboard, I think.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can have a surfboard. I'm not going to let you have a boat building kit.
No, that's a shame, but yeah, there should be a few waves on the island.
Do you still surf?
I do, actually, yes. Took it up again after a 38-year break and still managed to get up on the board and terrify the life out of other surfers as I come charging along at my 18 stone.
We shall give you a surfboard then. If I had to ask you to choose, just to save one of these 8 discs, which one disc would it be for you?
I think it would probably have to be the combination of the mesmerising poem of Dylan Thomas and the mesmerising voice of Richard Burton.
That's yours then, Tim Marson. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you very much, Kirsty.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs. You'll find more interviews with artists, musicians, scientists, sports stars, comedians and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs.
This is the BBC.